Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Gather Round. I'm Rosanna Marte Feo, and I just want to wish everyone a happy equinox. It is tomorrow, and here in the Noham, it's our spring vernal equinox, and in the Soham, it's autumnal equinox. So wherever you are, it's a good time to be thinking about balance. And I know that's something that it seems like I work on a lot. So I think other people probably do too. And one thing we need to remember is that your balance won't be the same as mine because everybody, of course, is different. So maybe for me, working 15 hours in a row and sleeping 5 and messing around for 4, maybe that's a balanced period for me. And maybe you need 8 hours of sleep. And that's good. That's you. So just think about what makes or what consists of balance for you and go with that. I wanted to remind everybody that Friday, the 21st, is the UN International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And I know that there will be some events aimed for the Palestinians toward Israel. And not just Palestinians, actually, because Israel's quite a racist country. But also I wanted to say that those of us in 269 Life, it will be joining in for the 5th worldwide event. And something to think about, speciesism is racism. So hold that thought. Now we're going to talk just a little bit about simplicity, which we've been doing an ongoing thing. And I know people say, well, you want us just to get rid of everything and not enjoy life, not do anything that brings us pleasure, and that's totally wrong. I'm saying, you know, the less things we have cluttering up our homes and our lives, the more chance we have of getting to know ourselves and getting to know what peace is. And, you know, like worldwide peace starts with peace within us. So it's a good thing to strive for, I believe. But when it comes to owning things, you know, you can enjoy something without owning it. I've had a couple friends that I had to be very careful what I said around them. If we were in an antique mall or something place like that, where I'd say, oh, that's beautiful. And then I can see, you know, wheels are going around. And it's like, well, they're thinking, maybe they're going to buy that for me. And I say, no, I don't want it. I just think it's beautiful. So, you know, I can enjoy it when I'm there, but I don't have to have it in my house. And, you know, something that might cost a few hundred dollars is, for me, I'd have to keep it away and up and out of the way of the furs anyway, so it didn't get broken and I'd be worrying about it. So what I have, some of the things that cost more money, I mean, they're pretty much taken care of, but I don't care to have a bunch of those things anymore. So it's just like if you want to vacation on the beach somewhere, Florida is my choice, Atlantic side, you don't have to buy the beach house. You know, you can rent it. Just like a fancy car if you want to show off, although you would, but to somebody for the weekend of your class reunion, go rent the car. You know, it's we can go ahead and enjoy things without having ownership. Because with ownership then comes the insurance. you're always worrying, you know, somebody's going to ding the car. Whatever. And not that you want it to be dinged if you're renting it, but there's insurance that somebody else is paying. So all of these things, take them into consideration when you're thinking about, wow, you know, I sure would like this or that. Well, is there a way that you could enjoy it without making the purchase, which might mean that you have to go into debt also, or you may have to get a second job or a third job in this economy? We're trying to free people up from working so many hours and just thinking about work because, you know, for most people, that isn't a true kind of happiness. Most people work at some job that's pretty rote, and they, while they're at work, they're thinking about, boy, when I get off work, I'm going to do this or that. They're too exhausted to do anything but go drink or something like that. So, you know, family time, time for friends, time for introspection, all of these things have always been important, but now it seems they're so much more important. So I would just ask that, you know, think about them. And the suggestions that I've been making, it's not something you would have to or even maybe be recommended that you try everything at once. But while you're going through your closets or while you're going through your bookshelves, you know, think, does this really bring me value? And if it's something that, you know, you set your own dollar limit here, you can say, well, if I can replace it for under $20, fine, I'm getting rid of it. I haven't used it in a year. And somebody else may say, well, okay, I'll make that $10 because I just don't want to have to spend $20 for something that I have right now. You set your limits. It might be five. You might say, well, I've not used it for 6 months. I don't know when I'm using it. It costs me under $5 to replace. It goes in the goodwill pile. You know, there's a lot of things that you can go by, different kinds of little things you can, I don't want to say fool yourself with, but make work for you. And I have found, because at one time with my thousands and thousands of books, I, you know, there's no way I'm getting rid of these. And then there came a time when I was thinking about moving to a country, and it's like, okay, well, I better think about this. Well, before I got rid of very many, that time I decided not to go. However, now I'm definitely cutting out my books. FreeCycle is a good organization or a good way to, you know, if you just want to give them away, check out FreeCycle online. Most towns of any size have something set up. There's always Goodwill and other agencies you can give things to. Ask your friends. They may have the same reading taste or clothes taste, whatever it is you do. But, you know, don't just pitch something unless it really is beyond all, what I want to say, all fixing, maybe. If it's that bad, well, and you've just been keeping it maybe for sentimental reasons, dump it. And take a picture if you want. You know, pictures take up a lot less room on your computer or even hand than the object will. So a lot of things that are sentimental like that, that you don't really want, but you think that you should keep it, just take a picture and run with it. It'll work. So yeah, I'm slowly, I have to admit, I mean, some things are going fast, some are going a little slower, but I'm getting rid of things. And with everything that goes out the door, it seems like there's just more space in me that opens up. So I'm loving it. So we'll be back next week with more outline. But right now, I want to call in our first guest. And tonight we're really chock full. We have Student, and then we have Michael Custer. And at the top of the hour, we have Tariq Jacobson with Ion Palestine. Well, actually, I on Israel, because there again we're seeing what it's doing to Palestine. But right now, let's see. Rusty Nugent, hello.
Hello.
Hi, okay, you were there. All right, he's here. And Rusty is an author. He has two books out right now, Moon Warriors and Moon Warriors, Guardians of the Night. These are considered dark fantasy. And I'm not really sure. Rusty, would you tell us exactly what that means?
Dark fantasy is usually fantasy, anything that's fantasy oriented, but with a dark twist to it, horror elements.
What kind of elements? Go ahead.
Horror elements.
Horror
elements.
Blood.
Yeah, horror elements. Blood, gore, scary, anything like that. It's not straight up, you know, horror, but it's has that element to it, but it contains things like witches, magic, fairies, anything like that in it. That kind
vampires?
Of thing. Yes, vampires. My book is about werewolves and vampires.
Oh, okay,
majorly.
You can find them. Okay. Well, how did you first start writing? I guess I should go back to the beginning.
Oh, goodness. Well, I've been writing since I was about 6 or 7 years old. But I didn't really become a writer seriously until I was much older, probably a teenager. But I didn't, I didn't really start writing a full novel until I became an adult.
Okay. Well, as a little kid then, while you were doing writing, were you an avid reader?
Yes, I've been an avid reader all my life. I was interested in books since I was like 3.
Yeah, me too.
oddly did it to me was when I was about 3, my parents took me to see, of all movies, Jaws. And when I found out that my mother had the Reader's Digest condensed version of the book, I begged her to read it to me. And she did for a little while, and then finally she said, look, when you get older, read it. So I did. I learned how to read, and I picked up reading really fast. And I did. I read the novel, and I've been writing and reading ever since.
Wonderful. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, now, Jaws is not a dark fantasy. When did you veer off into the dark fantasy genre?
Well, I've been a horror fan all my life ever since, basically ever since I was a child. But I've also always been a fan of fantasy movies like Sword and Sorcery, like Conan the Barbarian and stuff like that. And when I met my girlfriend, I kind of decided to blend the two, and I just kind of fell into it. We both have this interest in werewolves, and I said, you know, the werewolf always gets a bad rap as this bad creature. I said, why don't we make him a hero? So that's what I did. I wrote it for her. It's for her, yeah.
What
it's
a
her
wonderful
series.
Present. No, that's a wonderful present. Well,
yeah.
I know that there's an author called Laurel K. Hamilton, I believe, who has done some werewolves and vampires together. In some form, but you know, yours are set centuries ago.
Yeah,
and
I set my book. My first book was set in 800 AD, medieval days.
Right.
Yes.
And how? I mean, did you do a lot of research? I mean, extensive research to the time period. No.
I did so much research, I got sick of it. Oh, my God. I had to go back in time, and I researched so much folklore. Oh, my goodness. I went back, and I had to research werewolves and history, and I used all the realistic – I used real-life history things that I found that were very interesting that people would be like, you're crazy if you actually say that's real, but it's true. For instance, I found out – this is a fact – that in 500 B.C., this is what they say now, in Greece, in the Olympics, a werewolf won a boxing tournament.
What?
So I'm going to put that in one of my novels. Yes, this is historical fact. I read this and looked it up on the Internet. What was the other fact that I found out? St. Christopher, they found out, was indeed a werewolf, and the Vatican hid this information. So I'm going to use that, too.
Oh, my goodness.
That kind of thing. yes. I went back and researched vampires. I did all of this hard work. I mean, it was a long time. It took me 10 years to write all this. So I did a very extensive research.
Oh, my goodness. Ethan, give me a definition of a werewolf. If a werewolf won a boxing tournament,
that my idea of a werewolf and what some people's idea of a werewolf is two different things. I don't view a werewolf as a person who turns into a wolf. My idea of a werewolf is man-wolf. They're a hybrid. They're a two-legged creature with a wolf-like head. They have hands. They don't have paws. They walk on two legs. They are supernaturally fast, supernaturally strong, and that kind of thing. You know, they don't – that's the problem with a lot of these books and movies that I see. I'm like, when they turn into a wolf, they're pretty much helpless, you know? So – I'm like, no, they can do things that we can do. They can, you know, jump and climb and, you know, that kind of thing. So they have the ability to have fingers and stuff like that. So, yeah, they can box and stuff like that, yeah, hold things.
Well, how did St. Christopher get to be St. Christopher if he was a werewolf?
I have no idea, but I saw it on a documentary where they – knocked down an old wall somewhere in the Vatican, and there was a painting of St. Christopher, and they had walled it up. They had hid it, like top secret, where it was like classified, and he was what they said. He was a werewolf, and I was like, what? I was taken aback by it, too. It was hidden information, yeah.
Well, then let me ask you, how werewolves bioengineered? How did they come to be?
Huh? Say again?
Where did they come from? I mean, did humans cross with wolves?
Well, I don't really know where they come from. There's some kind of legend about dog-headed men in some country that they say that he came from or something, and that's how he basically already was, and he pretty much renounced it or something. I don't really know, but I'm going to have to explore that one further before I do. I'm going to write an origin book, but that's going to take a little bit, an origin book, how everything came to be.
Well, what you're saying, now I think there's a high percentage of people who believe, you know, that there's life off planet, some forms of life, and a lot of people believe that those forms have come here through the years, and so it sounds like maybe it could have been something like that to start with.
Hey, you never know.
Well, have you ever run into, in all the research, anything about, like, well, the werewolf's son, you know, junior werewolf, or the werewolf's mother? Is there a family group like that?
In my book, it's a curse that's passed on to the firstborn son, or you can be bitten, or you can be clawed, or anything like that. But as far as, like, traveling in packs, no. No. They have friends, but they don't live in groups and live in dens and caves and, you know, that kind of thing. They're still people, you know.
Right.
I tried to make it based in reality, even though they're supernatural. I still tried to make them reality-based. You know, I didn't try to go off the deep end and start adding all this – make it so fantastical where it's like, this is just ridiculous, you know?
Right. So like, it couldn't happen. Your books are the very best kind because the person can see this, like, okay, this could happen. Like,
yeah,
this makes sense, kind
of
thing. Like, it's sort of way out there, but it sounds like, you know, it could happen. Yeah, I love
it. Yeah, because I even based it in our past. It actually takes place in ancient Romania, which is Dacia. So, It's not like, you know, some place you've never heard of or, you know.
Right.
Nothing like that.
Right.
And, you know, the second book takes place today, now.
So
and
that,
the third book I'm writing on, so.
Okay, but now the third book is not the Book of Origins.
What?
The book about the origins isn't the third book.
No, the third book is the future.
Okay. How far in the future?
It won't be real far, but it's far enough that we'll probably see maybe the first few flying automobiles, maybe.
Okay, that doesn't have to be that far then, yeah, all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now, it has to be a different kind of research for that. You're going to be reading scientific kinds of papers, I assume.
Maybe. We'll see.
Or just pulling it out of what you already have found just in your imagination.
Some.
I think imagination plays a big part in this, too.
Some is based in fact, yeah. I try to blend the two.
Yeah. Do you said that you did this research for 10 years. My goodness. Do you have a real writing schedule? Like a lot of writers, it's like, okay, they get up at 4 in the morning, they write for 3 hours, and then they go and do whatever they do for money. And then, they, you know, every day, do you have something that set, or do you write when the muse strikes or what?
I just write whenever I feel it. I didn't have a schedule or anything like that because I didn't have a publisher at the time. And even now that I have a publisher, I don't have that, okay, we need a book in a month or, you know, in like 9 months or a year. You know, I don't have that hurry up. So I just write whenever I feel it. So,
yeah.
You know.
So any deadlines you have are the ones you give yourself?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. What was it hard getting a publisher? Or is this, because I don't know that much about this genre. Is it pretty popular? I think it is.
Well, it's difficult trying to get a publisher. It's difficult trying to get known. Right now, I'm still with one publisher, and I'm 2 years on that contract, and I'm trying to get with another one. But I got to wait for this one. This contract to run out.
Okay. Well, did you ever think about self-publishing?
Well, that's the thing. These two books are self-published, basically. I mean, they aren't, but they are, you know.
Okay.
It's kind of a weird situation.
Yeah, I mean, everybody writes one, you know. Some people want to self-publish so they'll have more say over, you know, their work, and
yeah,
pretty much like musicians. A lot of groups are self recording in because they don't want to deal with large companies. So
yeah.
I guess sort of, you know, six and a half dozen, and you see yourself just sort of which way the scale might tip.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, you know. It's on the one hand, you've got, if you want control over your music, it's the best way to, you know, or your writing or whatever, it's independence the way to go. But if you're looking for the money thing,
yeah,
the big boys are the way to go, but they want to tell you how to dress and how to write and how to do this and how to do that.
Exactly. So it's what
know.
We used to call selling your soul or selling out or whatever. And, you know, most of the writers I know truly are not writing to get rich. They write because they love to or because they have something they really want to say. And
yeah.
So they aren't, I mean, if money comes along, good for them. I know a lady who had written, God, I don't know how many books, and they were selling, but she had a publisher. And until she actually could quit her day job, you know, but she was doing it because the topic was, well, it was needed and people loved her books and she loved writing them. So there was a lot of labors of love in there.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think that you have, because, like you said, you've loved horror stories and everything since you were a kid. And you've been writing since you were very young, so this all falls into place. What did your girlfriend say when you gifted her with, you know, the series? My God.
Well, she's the one who told me to write it. She's like, write this for me. I said, oh, okay.
That's great.
So I wrote it for her. But,
Do you have, theme carryover? I mean, from 800 AD to present time, do you ever refer in the second book to what happened way back? Like, do you have any continuity in this?
Excuse me, I couldn't hear what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have continuity between this book now with the one that was 800? Okay.
Oh yes, I'm a big stickler for detail, and I try to make sure I don't have any like plot holes or anything like that. Like, how can this guy be living if I killed him all three chapters ago? And unless there's a reason for it, like, I thought I killed you, you know, or that kind of thing. How can he be? Well, here's the reason why, or whatever. But
right.
I always go through each book and edit it before I do anything else or anything like that. So yeah.
So it works. Yeah. And then the one that's going to be in the future, will it be the future close enough where you can use a character or two or more from this second book that takes place right now?
Well, that's the thing about me. I'm unpredictable, so you better watch me. I'm the kind of person, I'll just kill somebody off that's a main character, and you'd be like, oh, what? Because life is like that, you know. You lose somebody that you love that's close to you, and there's nothing you can really do about it. I mean, it happens in the first book. It happens in the second book to a degree. Third book, I'm probably going to go crazy with it. So,
those flying cars are in then. Okay. Well, now that's your third book. And then down the pipe, you've got the book that goes into the origins, which is going to be really interesting too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And do you see yourself down the road doing a different series or a different kind? You want to stick with dark fantasy?
Well, I'm actually also a horror writer too. I have two other books that I'd like to write. One that's going to be like a erotic horror book called Essence of Evil, and another one called Netherworlds, which is going to be like a short story anthology based on real life events that I'm going to fictionalize and make a little bit more, you know, terrifying. But
So you're pretty much sticking into horror or horror plus, then, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what you like. What do your, besides your girlfriend, what do your family say? I mean, do they like this? They know that you started reading so young and writing and all, and was this where they saw you going?
Well, the odd thing about my family is they know that I write, but I've only had like a couple of them actually read it. The one that's read it said, oh, my God, this is good. Most of them really haven't really, they either don't have time or they don't really express any interest, so.
Oh, my God, that's that whole a prophet in his own country kind of thing, isn't it? I mean, there you are. Well, maybe one of these days. But the ones that did really liked it. So that's good. I mean, it's nice to get feedback from strangers, but it's nice to get feedback from people you care about, too. So have you acted as mentor or, what do I want to say, teacher or just support for any other writers coming along?
Have I like taught anyone? Are you saying as a
or acted as a mentor? Maybe not quite teaching, but being there if somebody is ready and they just call up, Rusty. You know, I'm having one of those weeks. I've just got a block.
Well,
I can't get.
Well, I've given some people advice. Write what you know.
Or research
make sure that you know what you're talking about when you write it. When you write with conviction and authority. Like, you know, make sure that you know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, people will go, this person don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah. That's very good advice, though. It's like, be strong and know what you're talking about. Because otherwise you just look like an idiot. I mean, don't be wishy-washy about it.
Exactly.
Actually, that's good advice for a lot of things. I just wanted to touch on the fact you also do love music and you love drumming, I believe.
Yes, I used to be a drummer.
Used to? You're not playing now? Sometimes?
Well, I had to give it up due to my health. About 10 years ago, it was discovered that I was born with a congenital heart defect.
Mm.
And when they gave me my pacemaker, it gave me heart failure. So now when I play, I can play, but I get tired very quickly. So I can't keep playing for a long period, for 3 minutes. I'm like, I can't keep it up. So,
yeah, okay. That's what,
and music was my love, you know.
Yeah. Well, drumming, it takes so much out of a person. I go to festivals sometimes, and, you know, where people drum all night. And I just remember one guy who would come back to our camp in the morning, like 9 in the morning, because they drummed all night. And his hands were all swollen and bloody, and he was like some kind of a trance, you know. It's like, my goodness. But it really can take it out of you. So, it's good that you did it for as long as you did and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did. I loved it. It was writing stories and playing music was the only two things I was ever good at, and music's pretty much been taken away from me. So, writing's all I got is all I have left, really.
Do you listen to music while you write?
Oh, yes. It influences me a great deal.
Okay. It's
an epic thing, like, opera-type stuff, and then sometimes I get into some heavy, like, metal, sometimes opera metal, if it's what I'm feeling. And it influenced my books a great deal, so yeah.
Well, that part's cool. Do you have much music in your books?
Yes.
Okay. So you're combining your two loves, even though it maybe wasn't the way that you had thought it would be. They do it like 3 minutes at a time kind of thing now. But at least you have music you can listen to, and I hope that you recorded some things while you were playing so you have some of your own you can listen to.
Well, I did. I was able to record one song with me and a friend of mine, and obviously it was for my book, my first book, and I have it on CD. We recorded it in a professional studio, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
years
good,
ago.
No? All right.
Yeah.
Well, music doesn't get old, really. Not like those. That's great. I like that. Mm-hmm. So besides writing what you know and speaking with strong voice when you do it, is there any other advice that you would want to give anyone?
Make sure that you get a reputable publisher. Make sure, because there's a lot of people taking advantage of young, green authors out there, and they'll rip you off.
Yeah. That's unfortunately, that's the way it is, and that's very good advice. There again, for almost any life, I mean, be really careful before you sign anything.
Yeah.
Rusty,
and if you can't get an agent, if you can afford it.
Yeah, right. This has been great. I want to say that you can be found on Facebook at Rusty Newton, or what about the Phantom Wolf? It talks about your books there. That is phantomwolf.wix.com/Rusty Nugent. And on Facebook also, there's author Rusty Nugent. So it's to find you. And what is the best way to buy your books?
Well, you can go to Amazon, you can go to barnesandnoble.com, or you can, if you can't find them there, you can contact me through my Facebook or my email, which is yahoo.com.
Okay. So they're out there, but you can, by contacting you, people can get them also. So, Rusty, thank you so much. And
that was a pleasure.
Okay. Rusty Nugent, author of Moon Warriors and Moon Warriors Guardians of the Night, with the third one coming soon. And then there's the fourth one coming. And there's a couple more horror books coming. So, busy man, thank you so much, and happy equinox.
You're welcome. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was fun. Now, actually, from the same area code, we have Michael Custer. Hi, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, I am good. I was just talking with Rusty Nugent, who is actually, without saying the name of your town, from the same town you live in.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I thought, wow. Because I had never heard of that until I saw, where you and Sarita are, and it's like, okay, wow, interesting. So
yeah.
Tonight, we're going to talk about, and this is funny because we're talking about leaders are bad. We're not saying anything about bad leaders because there's a difference. Bad leaders could be a very good person who is just a crummy leader. But we're talking about leaders that are bad. I said we have lots of examples of that.
Yes. I mean, I don't even know if it's necessarily that leaders are bad or that leaders will become bad. Leading is enforcing your will.
Yeah, well, there's different ways of doing that. It doesn't always constitute taking bribes, okay? But having said that, we'll say that leaders become bad. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I kind of think it's I don't know how to say it. It's inevitable, you know. I mean, because a person who endeavors to become a leader has an agenda that they're going to go for full steam, and they'll do what they need to do to achieve that agenda, and that agenda may not always be the people who support that leader's agenda, and
it's very hard to find. I mean, not that they're not there, but it seems to be hard to find people who are genuine for the people and might even make a decision for the people that won't be a good decision for them.
Yeah, I mean, when we look at examples of revolutions, throughout the course of history, are you still there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I hear you.
When we, revolutions throughout the course of history, inevitably, the group that replaces the group that was overthrown ends up becoming the group that was overthrown.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen it hundreds of times in South America alone in the last 100 years, you know. And I think that the answer has to be actually finding a way to adopt a true direct democracy, you know, something where people actually vote on a nation's agenda, a situation where every law is passed through referendum. Like, maybe we'll
right,
have elected officials write the laws that we vote on, but that all the laws that become, anything that becomes law, should have to be voted upon by the people as a whole.
By all the people. And that's what people don't understand, this representation thing. It's, I mean, you know, it sounds good, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, we're going to vote reps, and so then they're going to... But with the technology the way we have it, why don't we use our computers? And, I mean, so there's a lot of people that don't have them, but the library... To me, it would be a lot cheaper to set up... computer stations for people who don't have them than to keep all the polling places going and pay all these people to watch the polls.
Right. Well, the answer to the question why don't we have that would be that our leaders would not have jobs anymore. And so, of course, they will oppose it. And if we look across the country, we see them taking steps to disenfranchise voters in state after state after state. It, you know, even things like, you know, the current drug laws ultimately disenfranchise voters who should still have a voice. I mean, they're still citizens.
Exactly.
So
that's true, because in this country, once you've been convicted of a felony, you can't vote, you can't have a gun, there's several things that you lost basic rights.
Right, and it's very difficult to get them back.
Yes,
you know.
Yes.
Although in some cases it can be done, but, yeah, I mean, and I'm not sure how we get to there from here, but I know we need to do it.
Right.
You know?
But you know, one of the things is making people just understand that it's very possible, like, that we could have this direct democracy that you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you had mentioned to me, why couldn't we just go to the computer week and read everything, at least the parts of it that interest us and what was going to be voted on? And
yeah.
Vote. Why couldn't we do, I mean, doesn't that, it sounds so simple.
Yeah. Well, there should probably be some other criteria, too. For instance, we shouldn't have laws that are so complicated that it takes a lawyer to understand them.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, mm-hmm. the notion that I would have to hire someone to interpret the law for me in to defend myself is crazy. I mean, if laws are so complicated that we can't understand them and have to hire someone to interpret them for us, then there's something really wrong, you
right.
know.
And I'm sure every state capital is the same. Also, you know, the aides are the ones, there's so many things coming through with so much attached to it. Because I think a bill should be voted on its own, not tacked onto the bottom of something else that nobody reads. And our representatives have aides that go through. I mean, they divide up and they go through. Tell them what it's because there's so much of this paper that the reps, even the conscientious ones, don't have time to read it all. And even though
right.
they're attorneys and all, many of them aren't attorneys, they don't understand it either.
Well, now, a lot of those things that get tagged on to bills, certainly not all of them, but a great many of them are continuations of earlier spending bills,
right?
So,
yeah.
And there should be a way to move big chunks of those through legislative branches, just for simple time's sake. You know, I mean, think of how many different things there are to to pass to fund a state.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, we're talking billions of dollars that have to be allocated each penny. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, conceivably, it would take them way longer than they actually have time to do anything, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if they study it at all or think about it or anything, they don't have the time.
But you're absolutely right, though, that they shouldn't be able to attach, say, an abortion bill to some form of education funding. You know, which is how they pass a lot of these really stupid
uh-huh.
things. I mean, a lot of people were really complaining about the veterans bills not getting passed, right? Well, they were attached to something else. There was something
yeah.
else attached to them that a lot of the Democrats couldn't vote for.
Right. I mean, they had nothing
what it was.
To do with it.
You know,
but it had nothing to do with the veterans thing. But that's it, because they tack things on. Instead of being
yeah.
open and upfront about it and say, okay, this is what's going to, you know, we're voting on this. And let people
yeah.
can talk. Let citizens, or, you know, have the some type of an online thing. You can state your feelings and blah, blah, blah. I just think that using the technology we have makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, with the things that Google is doing with voice recognition, speech pattern recognition, if we voice a concern through a medium like that, it could be 100% anonymous, and 2, attached to all these other concerns that are the same. So it wouldn't be like we would have to read a billion concerns over this one issue.
Exactly.
Because the technology is advancing to a point where the machines can interpret what it is we're trying to say and lump it in with the other things that are trying to say the same
yeah.
thing. You know?
Right.
I mean, the technology is getting really amazing.
It is. I mean, I'm very curious.
I'm very yeah. curious about what Google's true intentions are. I note that all of their services are offered to the general, consumer level services are offered for free. They make all of their money from advertising and from charging corporate entities funds, right? I know a lot of people are opposed to the idea of there being a central brain that all knowledge is stored in,
mm-hmm.
and I definitely agree with the concerns that if, for instance, Google had all knowledge stored in this one place, they could conceivably hold that knowledge hostage. And that is a very disturbing thought. But, boy, how nice would it be to have all knowledge there available at the click of a mouse for free?
No, definitely. But then the fear part, I mean, that comes in there too. If it was stored by 2 or 3 different companies or even more that
mm-hmm.
were not buddy, so that if one decided to do the hostage thing, the others would still make it available. I don't like all the eggs in the one basket thing so much.
Yeah.
And
I agree. And that's why I'm curious as to what Google's real intentions are.
Yeah.
I have a sneaking suspicion that they're revolutionary. just because they've been an amazing corporate success doesn't mean that they're not revolutionary, you know.
It is true.
It just means they found a model that they found a way to make their model work. But India did a similar thing recently. 5 or 10 years ago, there was a lawsuit from agriculture corporation tried to patent basmati rice, and then began to sue Indian farmers for growing basmati rice. Well, this alarmed the Indian government greatly, that someone could patent something that's been around for 10,000 years and claim it for their own. So,
yeah.
So the Hindu government decided to compile all the knowledge it could, all the open and free knowledge that India has, that the whole culture of India has, and put it in a central place. So that in the future, one could not say, oh, I just invented basmati rice.
Ah.
And I wonder if maybe Google doesn't have that kind of mindset.
That would be wonderful to think that is what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because right now everything's offered free. When they were doing their Google Books thing, you could go and check out, you could go and read a book. You didn't have to buy it from them.
Yeah.
And what made them stop offering the books was the author saying, oh, hell no. You got to pay me if you want to read my book.
Right.
I
get, back and forth, but as far as books, it's labor. It takes a lot of hours to write a book. And
it does.
So just like somebody who's working in a factory, putting in their hours, they should get something for it. There are countries, I'm sure you're aware, in the world that copyright doesn't mean it, jack shit. It means nothing. And those countries do basically steal a lot from others. And there's nothing you can do about it.
But what if we lived in a society which wasn't based on money? Some of the European countries are experimenting with paying every citizen a living wage just because they're a citizen.
A guaranteed income is a simple thing. I think
guaranteed income.
Mm-hmm.
And
we need
if we lived in a society that had that kind of thing, people would still write books.
Sure.
People would still try and find a better way to make the computers work, a better way to drive the cars, a better way to ship bananas. I don't think the notion of advancing technologies will end if capitalism ends.
No.
You know? And what a wonderful world it would be if
we just accepted the idea
that all knowledge and all art and is free.
It's there for whatever resonates with you. I mean, whatever you want to do or whatever you want to enjoy. Plus, you're going to have a lot more time for family, friends, for learning things, for doing things, and not be so exhausted. And, just come home and plop down on TV and drink a beer because you hate the world, because you hate your job. I mean, that will not be around anymore. So, no, what a wonderful world.
The question is, how do we get there?
How do we get there from here, right?
and I wish I had the answer. I know that it starts by having the conversation.
Exactly.
And it starts by outlining the world that you would like to see. Eventually evolving to actually creating a document like a constitution that enumerates the rights of every individual and the limitations of any corporate entity. Of course, if there's no capitalism, then corporate entities wouldn't exist in their current form, although there would still need to be some kind of regulation, because there would be someone who wants so badly to advance this piece of technology that they would be willing to corrupt the environment around them in order to do so. So there would still need to be some kind of regulations.
Yeah. I mean, But he can't, yeah. And I think about the trade with, like, because I live in the U.S., think about trade, because I use products that comes from other countries, not just from Mexico or Canada.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
yeah.
I think about trade issues. People who are in, say, Europe, where there's a whole gob of tiny little countries, or even like Africa, which has 56 countries?
Something like that, yeah.
They're not separated by oceans. And they can get to other countries, and they could trade easier than it would be for us. So I think that we have some kind of a body that did something with trading, for instance. So I think we're going to have different agencies, right? Somehow.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, because we're still going to want bananas, and mm-hmm. and Africans are still going to want maize, and you know, we're going to want the latest cell phones from Finland or Norway or wherever they're coming from right now.
And we're going to want to travel. I mean, so we're going to want a lot of that.
Yeah. I think one thing that's going to really be a hindrance in achieving a world like that are the religious fundamentalists of all stripes. I don't know how we overcome. You know, I watch what's going on in Africa, and I see Boko Haram. For instance,
Boko Haram, yeah, they're
you know,
totally insane. They say, I mean, what Boko Haram means is like Western education is evil, or I mean something to that effect. And
yeah,
that's what, you know, yeah.
And there's some legitimacy to that argument, but destroying, for instance, old ancient libraries is just inconceivable to me, and insisting on things like female circumcision,
right?
You know, those things. I don't know how we overcome those, especially since in many of those cultures, they're embraced even by the victims. How do we overcome that?
Education, but I'm not sure how to get that there because, you know, there's no religion that preaches that, and anybody who says that Islam backs that is totally wrong. I'm throwing it out there because I've heard people, ignorant people say that. But this was
right.
A cultural thing. And
well, it's like the Christians, the right-wing Christians talking about Jesus saying there shouldn't be gay people, but there's nowhere
exactly.
in the book that Jesus said anything about it.
He didn't. And, I mean, you know, we'll come have another show on, you know, the interpretations of the Bible. What we'll have to know is, think back to when that supposedly was put in. There remain people around, they wanted to populate the area, so guys with guys, you weren't getting any kids out of it. I mean, they threw things in, but then people don't go back to see what was going on at the time it was written. And
right.
why they say things like that. And, you know, when you start thinking, you start pulling things, you don't actually understand what some
right.
of this was about. You know,
and that's kind of like the Christians, the right-wing Christians, using arguments from the Old Testament to back up going to war.
I mean,
it's
and
very
the
clear
Old
that they're not even citing their own religion. For
no.
that,
no.
they're citing, you know,
right.
the Torah for it.
You know, they don't even get it, though, that if they say they're Christians, they're supposed to be under the new law, which was what was established when Jesus came, right? So
right.
that means you don't go by those old warmongering ideas.
Yeah. I believe what Jesus said was, "Verily I say unto you, you have the law, hold it and keep it. But I come to you and bring one law that if you follow, all the others will be kept, and that is to treat your enemies and your neighbors as you want to be treated.
There you go. Doing
I mean,
to others. It's
how,
a very basic,
how can
basic,
that even be, you know?
Question?
That,
yeah. I don't know.
I thought that was the whole basis for Christianity, that statement, you know.
Actually, any religion that I have looked into or spiritual path, if you go back far enough, it's all it's all based on love and compassion. That is
right.
And
stop hurting the other person.
Yeah. You know, do unto others there again. But it's like love, compassion, kindness, just as the core.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, our politicians who profess to be religious people should maybe get back to some basics. But so
yeah.
Our time's up.
Yeah.
I want you to come back.
And, I would be happy to.
All right. So I think we're going to turn the phone over.
Yes.
In your house. So I just wanted to say, Paul Custer.
It's the 615 show.
It's the 615 show tonight. But, shoot, I don't have it down here. An American Alarm Clock .blogspot.com.
Yes.
You'll find
the writings and rantings of a lunatic.
Ah, but.
Who may be more sane than he lets on.
Well, good rant. You know, guaranteed to make you think. So,
well, thank you.
Thanks
very
so much, Michael. Bye-bye.
All right. And you have Sarita already?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Then
there she
we'll
is.
We'll see you.
Let me just play this.
We'll
yeah,
see you the next
you.
Time.
And, yes. Okay.
Hi.
Yeah, it was your song, Shame on Israel. And well, I'm fine, except when it comes to Israel. That's always, you know, today we had another, well, actually, there were several attacks, but I think you had mentioned, and then I saw somebody sent it to me, and a young man was killed in Hebron today. For
yes, we have
like you told me. I mean, it doesn't matter because you know. I mean, all souls are just as valuable. But you know, you look at him, and he's a beautiful youngster, and you just look at him and think, you know. In the world that Michael and I were talking about, you know, down the road, I mean, think of the things he could do. What a wonderful life he could have had. And it's just very, very sad. I don't
very
even...
Very young.
I don't know. What has happened this past week that has really, really...
upset me.
Angered you.
What really angered me is they arrested the sister of Samir Al-Essawi, the football player from Palestine who was in administrative detention and hunger strike for over 100 days. His home now and happy, so they took his young, beautiful sister.
I saw something about... And why is this supposed to be? Just because they can?
They're not saying why. Just they can.
And
they
don't
can.
Have to. I mean, they
no,
they
don't. They don't have to say anything. They have no civil rights. If you're not Jewish in Israel, you have zero civil rights. Zero. And not you will be discriminated against heavily.
Yeah. It's like, well, It doesn't matter.
That is why I speak up.
Yeah, they don't charge people.
I'm ashamed.
Palestinians are in jail with no charges.
Thousands.
They're just there. So, do they
and
even
And they're
know?
Not just there. Have you heard of the conditions there, Captain? I was reading many blogs about it and heard testimonies from Israeli soldiers. I feel like I really know what's going on in the prisons. And they have no room to sleep. They sleep on the floor. They get tortured regularly with cold water, hot water, make them hot drinks, make them eat food that is dirty, make them live with rats, no heating, no cooling, no pillow, no family visits. It's hell.
Right. I did just read that there was a one-day hunger strike that was being organized in, I don't know if that was just like one prison or what the Palestinians were going to do. I don't know if that came through or not, but
there's so much going on, it's hard to keep up with everything.
Yeah, well it is.
Because it's over a million people suffering.
Well, in Gaza there's, a million and a half people right there.
I think it's 1.8 million by now. Yes. And yes, I would love to mention that the people in Gaza are having no fuel, no electricity, no clean water. It's very disturbing. I wish everyone would protest in their town for Gaza, because if they were in Gaza, they would want the world to do that too.
Exactly. I mean, how do you live when your food supply is cut off? And it's true, I mean, they try to grow what they can, but so many, orchards were demolished and things were shut down because you can only go, so close to the borders and all in the West Bank and Gaza, and you can't grow anything near there, I mean, near the borders. And so their ground that they have been growing on forever has been taken away. So, the tunnels are closed. There's nothing coming in. And I just saw tonight before we came on that Israel was holding up a bunch of UN aid to Gaza.
Oh, no, that is criminal. The people are hungry there.
I can't. I'll see if I can find it. It was. It was just. I got very upset. I mean, because the UN does occasionally, come through with something, and this was. Israel was just holding it up. I'm trying to find it.
I've seen Israel attack UN on YouTube. I wish I could.
Here we go. Israel blocking. I hate to do this as soon as it shows up.
Violation of international law.
Project. Okay, it's not food, it's projects. So, 15 projects worth $14 million are currently on hold, and 42 more projects worth $96 million. So that is $110 million worth of projects that can help the people are being held up by Israel.
It's pure torture.
Yeah.
40%
of people in Gaza are now jobless. So,
I'm scared. I hate it.
Yeah. I mean, anytime that you can't sleep, or you go to sleep, or your children go to sleep listening to drones, you know that you're psychologically being just destroyed. I mean, it's terrible. Should not happen.
It's a terrible atmosphere to raise children at.
Yeah.
And they arrested more children.
I saw that. I mean,
too young.
But,
Yes.
It's no wonder that Breaking the Silence, which is the organization by ex-IDFers who
are speaking out.
I mean, their conscience really got to them, and so they're speaking out. They weren't happy with what they did. They're ashamed of themselves, and they want the world to know how horrific it is.
And by the way, I wanted to mention that another soldier spoke out that he wanted to give a testimony to breaking the silence, and they wouldn't take it because it was too revealing, the fact that they try weapons on Palestinians in order to find out how good they are, what they do.
Right. Well. Okay. That must have been really horrid, because we know, and they admit that they try out different weapons on, like in Gaza. So
yes.
for them not to take it, that had to be horrific. It had to be horrific. That's all.
And they work with NYPD?
Yeah. Well, NYPD has an office in fucking but
exactly. That is weird.
When I first heard that and I checked it, it's like, my God, what is the New York Police Department doing in Israel? Don't we have enough crime going on in New York to take care of them? You know, to give them
so much.
That's
insane.
That is insane. With everything, I mean, you know, so much to this, though, Sari, it is insane. And if we didn't know that it was real and just so destructive and painful, I mean, we would think it was a joke. Like somebody's writing a sitcom, right?
Yes.
And so they're going to put the New York Police Department in Israel, and they're going to do this and this and this and try out weapons on these people who we stole the land from. But it's real.
It's very real. Very scary. And New York City Police Department has been pretty aggressive on Occupy movement.
Yeah.
They totally beat them, arrested them, in a country where the First Amendment is about freedom of speech.
Yeah, well, here it's like, okay, we remember that, you know, there's some amendments, there's some of these things, but nobody's... those in power don't seem to listen to them.
The people need to do something.
Freedom of speech is free if you're one of the so-called leaders who wants to tell lies. I mean, you can go ahead and do it, and the media will back you up. They'll tell lies too. But if you're one of the people who's trying to point those lies out, well, then you're on somebody's watch list.
Absolutely.
And I agree with, I saw a comment today. Somebody said, well, if you're not on a watch list, you're not doing enough. And it's like,
absolutely.
I agree. Yeah, yeah. It's like, get to
my
work.
My friend from Israel, I shared her status today because it's pretty revealing. She's an awake Israeli woman. And I'm translated it to English, so my translations, it's hard to translate, but I did. She's saying, when I say Israel is ruled by a demon force, she says they're clinical psychopaths, mentally ill and disturbed in a very high level. I'm not kidding. I'm not using curse words. I'm not exaggerating. This is just the truth. And every day that passes just exposes it more. I would not let those people take my dog for a walk.
Well, absolutely not. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, kicking the dog and trying to, well, never mind. No.
They approved the vote today also to make it, there's 25,000 mixed couples, people that marry Palestinians. So
right.
They approved the vote today, so the people they marry don't get any civil rights.
Ah.
So make it hard for them.
Sure.
So that way the spouses are left without option to earn a living, without access to social services, health care, danger of expulsion.
Oh, wow. So the
Nationality Act approved by vote again today. Yeah.
They took away all their rights. If you marry a Palestinian, all your rights are taken away. Because the Palestinians don't have any rights anyway, so then their partner has all their rights taken away. Yeah. Well, now you
I'm not
told
sure
me
the Israeli partner loses the rights. I think just the Palestinian one, I have to see. It's still pretty severe because I don't think the children would be recognized either. I have to look more into it. It's a long law.
Probably
but more than
not.
25,000 families live when one spouse is left without an option. Yeah, just one spouse. And expulsion.
I doubt the kids will. The kids won't have any rights. If neither parent does.
Yeah, the kids will be Palestinian. I think the Israeli parent gets some rights. I'm not sure. They sure won't be accepted by society. A lot of people in Israel have the thing not to rent to Arabs. They see all Arabs as the same. They cannot understand that Palestinians, you know, like in Europe we have French and German. They don't understand that there's like Palestinians or different culture from Jordanians and Lebanese.
Yeah.
Pretty strange.
They just lump. And you know, that's we in the West are guilty of that too. Think about the continent of Africa with some countries in it. You know, the people in South Africa are different from the people in Ghana, who are different from the people in Egypt. You know, I mean, it's a big continent, and yet they're all Africans, but they're very different. They have different concerns. They live in, like, different climates, everything.
Totally.
So you can't just lump all Arabs together because they live in different countries, different climates, different cultures. All this generalization, it's just not a good thing.
It's a product of ignorance. Totally.
What is? So
ignorance is so encouraged.
Well, I have... The breaking the silence people, they're breaking the silence like they have the Facebook group. And do they have an organization in Israel where they meet face-to-face, some of them?
They try to meet. They have meetings in the West Bank where they walk around the West Bank a bit and talk about what they did. I guess it's hard for them to talk about it. They have an organization called Breaking the Silence. You can find it on Facebook. And they're sharing stuff right now about the abuse of children, campaign against torture. They need to stop torturing children and adults. It's against international law, and you shouldn't do to others what you don't want done to you. So
well, that, I mean, so much that the Zionists are doing is against international law, but it's sort of like
they
just shrug it off, big deal. So as long as the United States backs them up to an extent, they're going to keep on doing it. It's
absolutely.
I did see that Bibi Netanyahu got a wild hair, and he was talking about it being, I don't think he used the word immoral, but anyway, something for countries to use BDS. And it's like, well, sort of like, how dare him? You know, he was just, he was calling us, again, anti-Semitic. I if I get called that by somebody one more time, I don't know. But you know, I mean, he was just saying that we're all anti-Semitic if we're boycotting. And
that's so silly.
Well, but you know, they use that word, that phrase, anti-Semitic, because it, some people cave in because they don't want to be called anti-Semitic. So
Palestinians
are
Semites.
I know.
So that's what we need to tell them. They're anti-Semitic.
Exactly. It's like, you know, so, yeah, he has come out. So my thing is, yay, if he is, like, talking about it and getting all excited, that means it's starting to show. It's working. So
it is working.
That's where we need to get down and, you know, really, really crank it out. Don't buy things with, like, 729 beginning barcode. Read your thing. And, you know, do some research. We've got the network. We can check things out. You don't have to buy things made in Israel, made in the settlements. It's just, you know, this is stolen land. And so these products are tainted. They truly are. I mean, if you believe in, like, energy and things like that, you don't want to use these products.
I don't.
No, no. It's, I mean, and if
I don't like it. And the way the Israeli government is treating my Israeli friends is also making me angry.
Yeah.
It's the common enemy of the people. The Israelis and the Palestinians need to unite against the common enemy.
Right.
Not be fooled.
Yeah. That's it. Because the government is against all of them. I mean, the government just wants
totally.
To... Totally. Yeah. So, and... But, and I don't know, I haven't seen anything in the past few days. Have you heard anything about all the Africans that they're trying to deport out of the country? Is
they
that
have
still
been deporting them and putting them in jail and not feeding them correctly and not treating them correctly. And many Israeli activists are getting arrested for protesting there. They don't have much freedom of speech there, you know.
Right.
It's brutal. Brutal to see how they arrest people just for going to show solidarity with them. Especially for people who have been through Holocaust, it's really hard to see other people. Holocaust survivors from Europe came to Israel to show solidarity with the Africans. It's very touching.
Oh, God. No. But, you
I
know,
totally
it's,
agree.
Oh, that is very touching. You know, years ago, and I'm sure it's still true in some, you know, South American countries and Mexico, Central America, and South. We used to hear about, oh, my God, you don't want to go to Mexico and get thrown in a Mexican jail. You know, it's like, oh, my God, there's nothing worse. Well, it sounds to me like the Israeli jails are just like the Mexican ones used to be or still are, whatever. I mean, being thrown in an Israeli jail, like you were talking about the conditions, I mean, that sounds like, you know,
worse.
Going south. Our border, yeah.
If you're Palestinian, I bet it's worse. It's it's something I can't even imagine going through. The way they torture them is disgusting. Tie them up to chairs and use electroshocks. Put out cigarettes on them. Some people have lost an eye because of torture.
Can you, you know, there's. I don't know. I mean, I understand about the brainwashing and dehumanizing people and all, but it's like, my goodness, doesn't something kick in? See, I guess it kicks in, like, too late. Like, that's why these people are breaking the silence. They went ahead. They thought, they believed all the lies, whatever. They did it. And now they see how misguided they were.
Absolutely. Many people regret it later, and many don't.
Yeah.
They are the problem.
Right, because they still think that it was right, or they have that just cruel streak that was encouraged in them.
So, yes.
You know, that's why we have a lot of, I can only speak for this country because of people I've known who've been in prison and things, but I suppose it's the same. I know it is everywhere. There are a lot of prison guards and people affiliated who really are cruel people, and that's why they go into that line of work.
That's true.
It gives them some kind of authority or something. And I don't know. I don't know what, I mean, but psychiatrists too, you know, whatever. figure out what makes some people more susceptible to harming others than
they do a lot of exams before joining IDF, a lot of exams, IQ tests, interviews, you go to a psychiatrist, so they know a lot about you by the time you join.
Right. So they know what buttons to push then.
I think so. They knew not to take me to the police. Some people, in Israel, when you want to be a police, it starts in the military. When you're in the military police, you get to pick on soldiers for not having their uniform right, or for a girl who forgets to put her hair up. Just little things.
Right. Okay. So you start out with those little things, and then you see who really gets into this, right? I mean, who
I am sure.
This authority and throwing themselves around, you know, yeah, okay. So then they'll make the best soldiers. This is just sickening.
A lot of people are refusing to be soldiers right now.
Yeah.
More than ever.
Since
numbers are up, yeah.
Yeah. What was the year? Was it 2008? We've got the highest right now number since several years ago. Yes. And it's like, great, keep this number rising. Speak out. And so I just really want to thank people and ask people, you know, send energy to these people in Breaking the Silence while you're sending energy and prayers to the families of, like, this child who was killed. And, you know, people who just are losing their homes.
Many people have lost their homes this week.
Yes.
And
yes.
Not only they lose their homes, they have to demolish their own home.
And pay, they have to pay for it. Now, can you imagine?
That is so evil.
They steal your property.
Totally.
They're stealing your house. And they say,
that's the most evil thing I've ever heard.
That there again, I mean, that's like that bad sitcom, but this is real life. Yes,
real life in Palestine, and then the Zionists dare to call them terrorists. I think they're pretty peaceful.
Right. I mean, I think they're peaceful. they haven't somehow managed to bomb out whatever. Yes. Just please send energy, good energy. And this is a time of balance. This is tomorrow, Thursday, is spring equinox here in the Nohem. In the Sohem, it's autumnal equinox. So it is a time of balance. Night and day will be the same. And
it's
time to, you know, go within and try to create balance in your own life, however that might be. And, you know, while we're creating our own balance, because we need to be balanced in whatever way is right for us so we can continue doing the work we need to do.
Absolutely.
So it's definitely a time. I love this time of year. I mean,
it's
spring
beautiful.
Is here.
Yes, it is at last. It was so cold.
So, Sarit, we're going to say goodnight for now. And I want to say that you can find Sarit at Sarit Jacobson or artofsaritjacobson.com, and Sarit is on Facebook also, and her art, because we never talk much about your art and your music. What?
Oh yes, I'm painting right now.
I love it. Yes. So well, keep painting, And when you get to the one you're doing of the Palestinian and the Israeli together, let us see. Put it where we can see. So.
Okay.
Good night. Good night. And
good
happy
night.
Okay.
Happy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.